Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of U.S. foreign policy post 9/11 with Graham Fuller, a former vice chair of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, who also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief. 10 years later, more bogged down than ever in Afghanistan, we'll ask whether we are playing into al-Qaeda's hands and digging the hole deeper with boots on the ground in Muslim lands. Then, in advance of President Obama's speech on jobs, we will look into the question of how a gridlocked Congress can create jobs and how the economy can be revived with David Corton, the co-chair of the New Economy Working Group. He has a plan to liberate America from Wall Street. Then finally, on this Labor Day weekend, Labor historian Jefferson Cowie, the author of Staying Alive, The 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class, joins us to assess the state of labor and how the American dream can be revived in an era of government bashing and lowered expectations. Joining us now is Graham Fuller, who's a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also serves as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. Graham Fuller has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, and most recently, A World Without Islam. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
And the news out of Afghanistan keeps getting worse, the latest being that NATO has issued a report saying that at least one in seven Afghan soldiers walked off the job during the first 6 months of this year. Do you think that there's any way that that the U.S. can continue this, what appears to be a charade, where we're talking about building a nation without a partner and an army with soldiers who desert?
Well, exactly. I think the problem is that with all the staggering amount of money, $1 trillion or so, that the U.S. is pouring into Afghanistan, it's just managing to keep it up, propped up as long as those forces, troops, and money are there. But I'm very concerned that the minute the U.S. forces leave, that the Afghan army will collapse as essentially a non-existing institution, and the Afghans are going to have to sort this problem out among themselves, which may be ugly, probably will be bloody for a while, but in the end, it's only a homegrown solution that's going to work, and not something imposed from the outside that won't last.
And Graham Fuller, as we approach the 10th anniversary of 9/11, and clearly what followed fairly soon thereafter, even though apparently the initial meetings at Camp David they discussed going into Iraq, at least Wolfowitz apparently brought this up. Obviously, they had to turn their attention to Afghanistan, where having realized that that al-Qaeda was responsible for the attack, this situation in Afghanistan seems to have gone from bad to worse. Is there anything that you could add that should have been done? I mean, in a way, it seems like President Obama and the Democratic Party dug a hole for themselves by suggesting that how absurd the Iraq war was, which is hardly news, but then they argued that we dropped the ball in Afghanistan and could have done it better. Could it have been done better?
Well, we did drop the ball in Afghanistan, and I think President Obama's reach for support to that war rather than the Iraq war was to indicate that he was not a wimp, that he was not opposed to all wars at all. But in any case, I think he made a mistake in embracing this so wholeheartedly because it has so many of the same problems, or even more of the problems that Iraq has. But, you know, could it have been done differently? Certainly, there was a very understandable desire for punishment of al-Qaeda, but I there are some interesting indicators that it might have been possible to extract bin Laden eventually from Afghanistan through the Taliban if time had been given to that scenario. Time was never given to it. I can't claim for sure that it would have worked, but it might have saved a war that has since then morphed on into not just get al-Qaeda, get bin Laden, but, you know, fix Afghanistan. And worst of all, from my perspective, Ian, is the desire to add Afghanistan to a collection of American bases around the world. And even today, given the trillions of dollars that have been spent on this, you see some elements within U.S. political body who would like to see us maintain these bases and begging Afghanistan, begging Iraq, can't you keep us there longer? Wouldn't you like us to stay on longer in what is a grand imperial effort that I think is leading really to the destruction of the U.S. economy and even domestic liberties and our society at large.
And just to go back to that notion that there might have been another way to have gotten bin Laden, my understanding is that before Bill Clinton sent the cruise missiles in, Prince Turki, who's head of Saudi intelligence, who during the Afghan war against the Soviets was effectively bin Laden's case officer, he apparently was negotiating with Mullah Omar. They were essentially going to buy the guy, and because to some extent, I guess, bin Laden bought Mullah Omar, and the Saudis, of course, having endless amounts of money, were able to up the ante. What's your understanding of that, that deal fell apart when the cruise missiles came in?
Well, I don't know whether the cruise missile attack would have been decisive in that case. I still think there might have been a possibility, and it's just a possibility that the Saudis could have bought bin Laden out of there. But more than that, I mean, most of the Muslim countries of the world were leaning on Afghanistan very heavily to say, look, this is an outrage. You can't protect this guy. And indeed, Mullah Omar, as we now later found out, was very angry with bin Laden for a lot of the domestic policies and actions. Bin Laden had promised that he would not engage in any foreign attacks from Afghan soil, and yet that was what he did. But Mullah Omar apparently felt partially bound, at least for appearance's sake, not to be abandoning up the sacred guest, a guest who has sort of sacred qualities for in Muslim society, at least for a while. So I think over time that could have worked, might have worked. But indeed, the goal was to get al-Qaeda and to get bin Laden and not get the Taliban itself, which is a whole different undertaking. Nobody thinks the Taliban were a great regime, but look at the number of regimes around the world that are not great at all. So I think when the war morphed or the effort morphed away from an al-Qaeda focused thing to Afghanistan as a whole, we really bought deeply into a hopeless can of worms.
Again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, who is a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council. He was also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief. But if you go back, as we are on this particular day or this week, Graham Fuller, thinking about 9/11, 10 years after, it seems that the picture is so counterintuitive. It's just shocking to think. When I ask you, could we have done it better? I guess in this case, the question would be, could we have done it worse? I mean, the attack happened there in New York, which is the home of the United Nations. There was that moment when the French newspaper headlines were "We're all Americans." The whole world was sympathetic to the United States, and that was so quickly squandered, where the victim of 9/11 became the victimizer, and we struck out blindly around the world. So, without revisiting the sorry history, do you think that we couldn't have done worse than what we did?
Well, I think the problem, in part, is that we began mixing imperial ambitions, which really fell into place after the collapse of the Soviet Union. This was America's hour, its year. Indeed, the 21st century was to be the American century, when the United States would be able to run the world and decide what was going to happen, who would take what role. So I think that imperial role, in other words, 9/11 played into those imperial hands, and particularly as seen by neoconservatives. It ceased to be just about terrorism, but became, in the name of terrorism, a much grander experiment. And I think that is what alienated so much of the world. It wasn't just style, but it was also the imperial vision. And secondly, I'd have to say that obviously there was an immense terrorist problem with al-Qaeda, but essentially this is not something conducive to a military solution. And 10 years after the fact, we still really haven't learned that. It's a police problem, it's an intelligence problem, it's a diplomatic problem, and I think we've got potential allies all around the world, real allies all around the world, who are willing to engage with us in fighting this problem, because it's not in their interests either, or in their own societies. But the problem was that I think as we seem to be taking on all of the Muslim world, troops in countless countries, war in several countries, and sort of Islamophobia springing up naturally in some of the in this process, that it did become perceived as a war against Islam, and Muslims became very, very defensive. This played into the hands of Islamist extremists, who were saying, look, we're here to fight the American invader, to fight American occupations, to preserve Islam. And when you have rhetoric like that and wartime situations of desperation, and frustration and anger and all of this, of course the radical views predominate over the moderate ones. So, you know, I'm afraid we've really dug ourselves in a very deep hole here, Ian, and I don't see any way out until, at the least as the first step, American troops are withdrawn entirely from all the way around the Muslim world. The problem does not immediately go away, but that's a big, big first step towards taking the initiative away from Muslim radicals, who will then lose their cause.
So, Graham Fuller, is that to say, I mean, when you talked about the neoconservatives, because Paul Wolfowitz had this notion, which apparently he sold successfully to President Bush, and presumably Cheney had the same feeling, that this was our moment. The Russians had finished. We're ruling the world. And if we don't seize the moment now and reshape the world according to our wishes, eventually we're going to lose this window because the Chinese will come along eventually, etc. That's my understanding. But on the other hand, it seems as though what actually happened was we were goaded into an endless war by a hopeless fanatic who we ended up playing by bin Laden's playbook. If his desire was to get us to waste our treasure and lives and waste our good name around the world legitimize his bizarre notion of the Crusaders coming to steal your oil and steal your lands, we've been playing by bin Laden's playbook, surely.
Well, I'm afraid there's a great deal of truth to that. It's very clear that bin Laden and al-Qaeda has continually wished to see the United States drawn in ever deeper into this quagmire, because it benefits them. As soon as U.S. troops leave, their own argument that they are there helping fight American resistance falls by the wayside, And as I said, I think you then have a chance for more moderate Muslim voices to emerge. Now, this doesn't mean that more moderate Muslim voices are going to want to have U.S. troops on the ground. I mean, very few countries, very few peoples in the world want to have foreign boots on the ground when they're of a different religion, a different language. I mean, I'm amazed that Americans don't think back to, you know, our own Revolutionary War, when the foreign occupiers were British, speaking the same language, same religion, and same everything as so many of the American population at that time itself was. So I think it's very understandable that you're going to find really sharp reaction to raids and cruise missiles and Predator missiles being slammed into countries even with whom we are not at war, as is the case in Pakistan. And that policy is bringing, by the way, Pakistan, I think, to its knees as well. But that's another related issue. Yeah, so the short of it is, I think we have fallen into a trap that the radicals really hoped would happen and still hope will happen. They don't want us to really leave. It's interesting, the Taliban want us to get out of there because the Taliban are essentially a very nationalist Pashtun organization. They want America out big time. But I'm sure that the al-Qaeda groupings there would like to keep on just perpetuating this forever.
Again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, who's the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief. When you mentioned earlier, Graham Fuller, about the growth of Islamophobia in this country, and it became very apparent with the Norwegian assassin who killed all those people, that he was influenced by a lot of American Islamophobes who are quite prominent over here. But I'm curious to know why it is that American Muslims have not been held up as the model of how Islam can coexist in a pluralistic society like the United States. I don't understand why, instead of sending armies abroad, we don't send soap operas showing how Muslims live in this country, in a free country, and are able to freely practice their faith. That would seem to me to be the strongest argument that the United States could have. And I know you, as a private citizen, appear often on Al Jazeera making trying to argue, if you will, put the best foot forward for the United States in spite of our foreign policy. In other words, I guess what I'm getting at in a long-winded way, Graham Fuller, is that no Muslim or no Christian or Jew can dissuade a young Islamist who's about to become a radical. The only person who can dissuade a young Islamist who's about to take the path of radicalism is a more moderate Islamist. And surely we should have been nurturing moderate Islam and using the model here in the United States as our best argument, instead of alienating the very people that could get us out of this hole.
Yes, I agree with you, Ian. I'm a little more positive in the sense that I think that is really actually happening, and I don't think we need the U.S. government to do it. The Muslim population now in the United States, and the exact figures aren't even known. I mean, I give roughly about 6 million people, essentially are a highly law-abiding and very committed population. There have been lots of recent statistics showing that a high degree of tolerance towards other groups within the United States. Muslims are successful professionals. They're community-oriented. The mosques are reaching out to other religions. So I think the case of Muslims in America is going to be ultimately one of the really successful cases of Muslims coming to the West. Not so in Europe, where a huge portion of them have been workers, working class, often peasants, who were brought there to do physical labor that Germans or French or English or others did not want to do. And naturally, that blue-collar segment is less easily able to become integrated into European society. And so I think the Islamophobia in Europe is much deeper, and Europeans are sort of much more terrified of immigration in general, much less Muslim immigration. We don't have that in this country, and that was what I find so very positive. When you look at the history of the integration of other undesirable peoples, as it was viewed in past centuries. I mean, there is a huge anti-Catholic thing for a very long time. As you know, Catholics were viewed as suspicious and Pope-loving, and you and I are old enough to remember that JFK was, well, people wondered whether he was even electable because he was a Roman Catholic and might take orders from the Pope while he was president. And Jews have been through a long history of this, and Jews indeed have written about this a great deal, about how Judaism was vilified and why couldn't Jews ever assimilate, and was there something about Jewish religious law that kept them distinct from everybody else. In other words, our country has been through this, and I think out the other side positively with other religious groups, and I'm really pretty confident it's going to happen with Islam. But having wars against Muslim countries, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, depending on how you qualify them overseas, does not help the situation and places American Muslims in almost an intolerable situation of being viewed with suspicion as possible fifth columnists or whatever else. But that really hasn't happened.
Well, of course, what has happened, interesting enough, just in closing here, Graham Fuller, is that the Arab Spring has sprung up, and we had nothing to do with it. And finally, our foreign policy, the realpolitik, where you act according to your interests, not according to your ideals, is coming a full circle, surely. Now it would seem that the United States would be better off acting according to its ideals, not necessarily in its interests.
Well, I don't buy the argument that, well, we have to do these things as distasteful as they are because it's in the American interest. I mean, the whole debate about foreign policy is what exactly are American interests. Are they towards maintaining perpetual war and having, you know, 70, 80 military bases around the country and the ability to call all the shots and be the world's policeman? Is that our interest? Or is it really to work with other countries and groups and cooperate on these various things? So I find that a false argument. But basically, yeah, I think we've got to fall back on our domestic values, which is what we are strong at as a tolerant society, still with opportunity for all, freedoms which are being, I'm afraid, somewhat weakened, but nonetheless they're there. That is the strength of America, and what makes America appealing to other countries in the world, including Muslim countries. They do not hate our values, but for sure they hate our foreign policies, and that is what has to change.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Graham Fuller.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who was the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief. He's currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University, and he's lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades as the author of numerous books, including The Future of Political Islam, and most recently, A World Without Islam. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about President Obama's jobs program.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand up next to you when they met her. But there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA. Money.
And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. David Corton, who is a journalist, author, analyst, and economist. He is the chairman of the board of Yes Magazine and co-chair of the New Economy Working Group. He has been a Harvard Business School professor, a captain in the United States Air Force, a Ford Foundation project specialist, and a regional advisor to the U.S. Agency for International Development. His books include the international bestsellers When Corporations Rule the World, The Post-Corporate World, Life After Capitalism, and The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community. His latest book is Agenda for a New Economy, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Corton.
Delighted to be with you, Ian.
And the president is supposed to do a speech on Thursday about jobs. Already the Republicans have shown their disrespect and disdain for our first black president by fighting over the timing of the address. I'm not sure a speech is going to solve the problem, but what do you think the president can say?
Well, that's a very interesting question. He could say most anything. My guess is that his speech will focus on the points that he's already been making about jobs, pushing trade agreements, which is a net jobs killer, proven time after time. He talks about payroll tax cuts, which undermine Social Security and Medicare by reducing their funding and giving the Republicans more traction to overcome those. I'm hoping that he will put some emphasis on the other proposal that he's put forward, which would be an infrastructure bank to finance rebuilding America's infrastructure. Now, there are two big questions. How is that done? And what I'm hoping for is that he might suggest a focus on rebuilding our national infrastructure around green energy and retrofitting our buildings for energy efficiency, building a modern transportation system that is not auto-dependent. Whether he will do that or not, I don't have a lot of confidence. The other interesting question is, how would it be funded? And, the conventional answer would be funded through borrowing from Wall Street. I think the more interesting idea is one that Bill Greider, who's an expert on the Federal Reserve, has put forward, that an infrastructure bank could be funded directly with Federal Reserve money that otherwise goes into the Wall Street banking system to fund their speculations, corporate mergers, CEO bonuses, and so forth. But that money could instead be directed directly into the infrastructure bank, so that new money creation actually flows into the real economy rather than into the Wall Street economy. So that's one initiative that I hope he will bring forward. Now, of course, the things that he's not likely to bring in, but are the things that we really need to focus on for long term in terms of putting America to work, building a 21st century America. The first and obvious one is increase taxes on Wall Street and redirect that money to Main Street. Now, this relates to the fact that we've got basically two economies in America, a Wall Street economy and a Main Street economy. And the advantage is the policies all favor Wall Street, which specializes in speculation, asset bubbles, asset stripping, usury, and a whole lot of other things that do the economy no good. And in fact, Wall Street is extremely efficient at destroying jobs, offshoring jobs, downsizing, and so forth. So, putting money into Wall Street is not where you want it to go. And yet, over the past 30 years, virtually all the benefits of economic growth have gone to Wall Street. So that should be sending us a message that we're not paying attention to. It's Main Street economy where the focus is on putting people to work, producing goods and services that are essential to daily living. So, in a sense, the more we tax Wall Street to finance projects that put money into Main Street, and particularly our local banks, the more our economy is going to flourish. Now, other major initiatives, there are a lot of folks around the country working on on legislation to create state banks on the model of North Dakota. And it's very interesting. Ellen Brown just published an op-ed noting that the unemployment rate in North Dakota is 3.3%, contrasted to the national 9.1%. They've had annual payroll growth of 5.2%. The state has continuous budget surpluses, and it has the nation's lowest foreclosure and credit card default rates. And that much of that can be traced to a state bank that keeps money in the community in North Dakota and circulating into through community banks that are funding local businesses and local farmers. The other really big issue that is exactly the opposite of his focus on trade agreements, which will further push the outsourcing of America's manufacturing and research capability, is to rethink fundamentally our international economic policy framework to put a focus on rebuilding American manufacturing and research and moving the international economy frame from one of free trade to one of balanced trade, where we're not running up huge international debts, but we are actually engaged in the kind of trade that is the foundation of real market trade theory. So those are my my suggestions on what I'd like to see Obama say and what I hope he will would move away from.
So David Corton, how you've written at your blog at the New Economy Working Group, how to liberate America from Wall Street, and it would seem that the liberation has to take place politically, because the reason we've had these policies is that they've Wall Street has captured our government, and as you know, our government operates on money. It's all about money, and the Supreme Court has now opened the floodgates to unlimited money. So that means the more money you have, the more political power you can buy. That's the unfortunate situation. The North Dakota model is extremely interesting. How do you expand that to a national model?
Well, essentially through, one would be the initiative suggested with the Federal Reserve. I mean, creating an infrastructure bank that's funding projects that put money into the economy at the local level, hiring workers to rebuild America's infrastructure. But the other piece of that, of course, is fundamentally reforming the Federal Reserve, which now operates essentially as an arm of the Wall Street bankers, and mainly concerned with maximizing the profitability of these predatory banks. We need to make that a true federal institution. It needs to have some independence, but it also needs to be accountable to the public interest, not the Main Street interest. It's been creating money with accounting entries. At the time of the financial crash, the audit showed that the Federal Reserve essentially created some $13 trillion. Just with accounting entries, feeding it primarily into Wall Street as well as into foreign banks and corporations. That's a basic part of the money system. But instead of feeding that new money to stimulate the economy into Wall Street institutions that use it to play these financial games, it needs to be fed into something like an infrastructure bank that puts that new money directly to work in the productive economy. Now, the whole idea here of that report, how to liberate America from Wall Street rule, is to recognize that the money system is the system of power in society. It works kind of like the operating system of the economy. And the issue is who controls the creation and allocation of money, which then determines where money flows. And Wall Street's been in a campaign beginning in the 1970s of shifting us away from a system of community banking, local banks, credit unions, mutual savings and loans, many of them organized as cooperatives, that effectively controlled the creation and allocation of credit and focused it on funding local businesses, homeowners, farms, and so forth, to create community wealth, to engage in productive activity. Now, through the process of deregulation, Wall Street has consolidated that power unto itself, shifted it away from the community level, and at the same time then transformed it from focusing on real investment and creating real wealth to funding speculation and all of the games that Wall Street now plays, not even to the benefit of the shareholders of these banks, but mainly to maximize the generation of CEO bonuses. So,
and that's the too big to fail monopolies, where five banks basically control the entire economy. So, just in the last couple of minutes, then, David Corton, what do we do about the 18% unemployment amongst Americans under 24?
Well, that, of course, you know, any job initiative starts with activities that put money into the Main Street economy, where people can create jobs. The youth unemployment problem is, of course, a critical element of the overall unemployment problem. It's the new people coming into the workforce have the biggest difficulty finding jobs, and of course it's not just youth, it's also particularly communities of color and particularly African Americans that have the biggest problem finding jobs. And of course, if we're creating jobs in the construction industry, we are creating jobs that can absorb some of that younger population. So I don't have specific suggestions particularly targeted to those groups. I think, we need to deal with the overall situation, and that presumably will benefit all.
Well, the irony is, of course, these are the young people who voted for the president, and if they don't vote next time around, we'll have President Perry. I thank you for joining us, Dr. David Corton.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to be on your show.
And then we'll revisit this later next week, I think, if you don't mind.
Excellent.
I'd like to catch up more with you. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. David Corton, a journalist, author, analyst, and economist. He's the chairman of the board of Yes Magazine and co-chair of the New Economy Working Group. His latest book is Agenda for a New Economy, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth. Let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a labor historian.
There once was a union maid, she never was afraid of the goons and the ginks and the company finks and the deputy sheriff that made the raid. She went to the union hall when a meeting it was called. When the company boys come around, she always stood her ground. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me.
Since the 1st of June, lost my job and lost my room. I pretend to try, even if I tried alone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jefferson Cowie, who's an associate professor of history at Cornell University. He's the author of Capital Moves, RCA's 70-Year Quest for Cheap Labor, The Long Exemption, An Interpretation of the New Deal from FDR to Obama, and Stayin' Alive, The 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class, which received the 2011 Parkman Prize from the Society of American Historians. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jefferson Cowie.
Thank you very much.
And, of course, we are speaking on the Labor Day weekend, and inevitably we are looking at the state of labor, and, of course, the statistics are so shocking and depressing in the sense that about 7% of the private workforce is unionized, and that number has been going down since FDR. Is this inexorable? Will there be a reversal of this trend, do you think?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. The slide has been going on really since 1955. That's the peak of density of unionism in America. But then it It was a general sort of gentle slide, and then it became precipitous in the late 70s and into the 1980s. And it's a decline that we have not ever recovered from. And it really speaks to, a lack of organizing and a lack of vision early on in terms of the economy shifting from an industrial to a post-industrial economy and beginning to tap into workers in service and workers in information economies, women, immigrants, all the people who make up the new working class.
So do you think that there's a possibility here in the United States, since so much of our mythology is based upon the American dream, anchored in the middle class, that there will be a political awakening? I don't know that's premature to declare the middle class dead, but it's certainly an endangered species.
Yeah, I thought the outlook might be a little bit different 2 years ago by this time, but it's just gotten worse and worse. And I think there already are signs, I believe, that people are beginning to take inequality very seriously as a very, very important issue in the United States. And most importantly, you mentioned the American dream. As I joke to my students, the American dream is alive and well, but it's in Denmark, where social mobility has decreased in this country to the point that people are beginning to feel themselves stuck. And one of the core elements of the quote-unquote American dream was that you could, with hard work and pluck, you could work your way up the ladder. Well, those ladder rungs are now missing, and people are stymied and having troubles moving upward. And without the types of safety nets we see in other countries, we're not going to be able to, that's going to be, those class structures that we try to avoid as a nation are becoming more and more reified here, while there's more mobility in the, allegedly class structures of Europe.
Again, I'm speaking with Jefferson Cao. He's an associate professor of history at Cornell University and author of Staying Alive, the 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class. But is it possible, though, that when we talk about America, we should talk about two Americas? In many ways, it seems that the Mason-Dixon line is alive and well, the difference being that the Dixiecrats in the South, who used to be in the Democratic Party, now control the Republican Party, and they clearly have a presidential nominee in the form of Texas Governor Rick Perry, who's way ahead in the polls on the Republican presidential sweepstakes. So, his writings and thinking, if that's the right word, are so reactionary, it's shocking. But then you realize that this is a part of this kind of right-to-work Southern tradition of the plantation economy. So,
well, that's what's interesting about this is, you're right, the history of the post-war period, post-World War II period in the United States has been, as the South shifted from Democrat to Republican, and the Dixiecrats became Republicans, especially after the Civil Rights Act and things like this. But the other side of the story is sort of the Southernization of the United States. It used to be the South was the anomaly. It was, it was the part of the economy and the politics that didn't make sense in the national narrative. Now it's become the national narrative, whether it's, you can see it culturally, say, in the popularity of country and Western music, which used to be a regional music, all the way to the way politics works or that, the Democrats lean on Southern, moderate Southern Democrats to lead the party. So many of the cultural issues and the political issues and the economic issues have actually that define the South have actually been nationalized across the country, and so now it's there's pockets of regional pockets of resistance to that, but it's getting very, very scary to me how this works, and the least of which is evangelical Christianity, which used to be a fairly regional phenomenon as well.
Well, one of the aspects of the Southernization of American politics has been this requirement for supermajorities, which
right.
came out of the Jim Crow era to keep the black majority down. and it becomes, you know, ruled by the minority. And of course, the Republicans are now deeply vested in this new constitutional amendment to have a balanced budget, which requires a supermajority. Again,
the single most important reform I think we can do is to get rid of the filibuster. Because you're right, the supermajority requirement that is basically inherent in any piece of legislation now came out of two issues. I mean, it was used throughout the 20th century for two issues. One, to maintain racial segregation. Two, to defeat any kind of progressive labor legislation. And until we get rid of that, and it's easy to do. It's just a rule. It's not in the Constitution. It's merely a procedural rule. It could be done away with tomorrow, but nobody will take it on.
Well, I was going to say it has literally hamstrung the state
completely.
Of California because of the two-thirds requirement in both budgets and revenues, and it has allowed a small minority of highly ideological Republicans to, in fact, rule in this majority Democrat blue state.
That's right. You combine that with a hardening of those ideologies with a supermajority, and you have, and especially, you know, the Republicans show up to play, they show up with chains and knives, and the Democrats show up to play softball, and you have a very scary situation.
But what's going to happen, though, in terms of moving from the political reality, which is pretty dismal, and it is hard to kind of grapple with this disconnect between economic realities and political possibilities, and we seem to be sort of helpless and floundering at this moment. But presumably, a lot of people, the biggest party in the United States is none of the above. I'm not a Democrat and I'm not
right.
a Republican. So there's some reason to have hope that there's some stirring out there. What about a stirring amongst the working class? What about the idea of reviving labor and people basically giving up on this quixotic notion that you can win the lottery, or you can, your freedom is tied to a billionaire's right not to pay taxes?
Right. Yeah. There used to be something we called, the working class, that had some sense of shared collective economic destiny in this country. I argue in the book you mentioned, in the 1970s, it fell apart and a new one failed to reemerge that could bring together the new social movements of the 60s and the old class-based movements of the 30s into a new kind of vibrant working class movement. And so now we have very little tradition to build upon today. And I think that's both promising and problematic. It's problematic because we do have to start anew. But it's promising because we're not hamstrung by old visions and old shibboleths about how to make the country work. And I think that this is where I'm always criticizing the New Deal as, what we need is a new Deal. What we need is a new Deal. I'm always trying to find new formulas, new approaches, new ways to ignite political and workplace actions that speak to our own time. And I'm still struggling to do that, and I'm not quite sure where their energy is going to come from. But if it comes from anywhere, I think it's going to be the immigrant working people of today. I think that's where animosity from the right is coming, but I think a lot of the hope for the left is also coming, would be amongst immigrants.
And what about the different course that the United States has taken in compared to the other social democracies? You mentioned jokingly about Denmark earlier. It is puzzling to think that in a country that has a sort of basic bottom line thinking, that the average American does not is falls for the argument that they're taxed too much, as opposed to the real question is what happens to your tax monies and what do you get back? And that this basic transaction that's understood in other social democracies that you pay your taxes and you get your government services.
That's right.
And nobody thinks, I mean, the right has been so successful in demeaning the very role of government and leaving everybody at the mercy of the marketplace, which ought to be clear that that is a fate worse than death.
Right.
So how do you revive this idea? Because, you know, frankly, Social Security is a fairly simple, well-run system. I don't know what the hell all this propaganda is about. I mean, this Perry guy is talking about it as a Ponzi scheme. I mean, work? Are people that gullible?
Progressives really have to take seriously the anti-statism that is very strong in American culture. And it's very difficult to do, to simultaneously try and figure out ways to move forward while recognizing this kind of anti-statist impulse that is very deep in amongst citizens in the U.S. I'm not trying to create some sort of cardboard cutout portrait of American voters, but I do think there is something there, and we have to be very careful about how we talk about these things. But my biggest hope for Obama. My only hope for Obama, actually, when he was elected, I never really thought he'd be anything more than a very good neoliberal president, and I think he's been a poor neoliberal president so far, was that he would begin to make the argument that the state had a place to a positive role to play in people's lives. And I think the way you do that is you say, okay, what are the mechanisms for an individual to be able to rise in this country and to be able to make it. And it's through a set of collective resources, whether it's Social Security or public education or, healthcare, that these things provide a bridge between one particular individual's sets of hopes and dreams and a broader collective destiny. And I don't see those arguments coming out of Washington right now.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Jefferson Cowie, a professor of history at Cornell University and the author of Staying Alive, The 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class. The Democratic Party, not to mention the president, seemed to be so supplicants, if you will, to Wall Street that they truly have lost sight of the history and heritage of the party. The 30s look what's happening now. The next Democratic convention is going to be in North Carolina, and the
right.
AFL-CIO are really furious because they're hosting them in all these non-union hotels.
Yep.
It just shows you that the party doesn't give a damn about the unions anymore because they don't have any money. Which is that's a self-fulfilling prophecy of doom, surely.
I agree. I wanted to back up just a minute and talk about taxation and the role of the state, because all these presidential candidates since Reagan have been talking about rolling back the state, cutting the state, and the state's been doing evil things to you with your resources. But nobody has ever said who has actually reduced the size of the state. And the answer is none of them. The state has continued to grow across the board. The question we need to begin to pose is, whose side is the state on? And obviously, nobody's actually reducing it, so therefore the question is the state doing serving businesses' interests or the people's interests? And I think if we can begin to think about that a little more effectively, we might be able to begin to change the discussion. And I agree. It used to be that nothing could come out of the Democratic Party without union endorsement, the union bug on the literature, and the union hotels, the whole thing. And those days are limited. I think Rich Trumka has been doing a pretty good job of arguing labor's points with the administration, but you know, I think it's a little bit too late, and we're not seeing much in the way of mobilization around these issues, I think.
But I think the argument, when you talk about how the debate over the state should be revisited, but it also should be reframed. I mean, there are two narratives here, the right wing and the Republicans. Their idea is to use the state to transfer public money into private hands. And they've done that with gangbusters, and Bush has grown the government, but he's only grown it in terms of contractors and the Halliburtons. And, of course, the states, the state's just this big piggy bank. But it happens at the expense of real social services. And so we have right-wing welfare in this country, not traditional welfare.
That's exactly my point. It's like, okay, nobody genuinely reduces the role of the state. They just shift it to other sectors. Class war is actually alive and well in Washington, and they're doing a great job of siphoning resources to the types of contractors you're talking about, tax subsidies to the rich, you know, the famous GE case where they didn't pay money, they received money from the federal government, and there's scores of other cases like that. GE's just become the most famous. Whereas, you know, we need to cut services to the poor. We can't afford health care, but yet we can afford these wars. It's truly a looking glass kind of political discourse.
Well, just in closing, Jefferson Cowie, at times I wonder whether, given the ascendancy of Ron Paul in the Republican Party, at least in terms of the debates, obviously the establishment would like him to go away.
Yeah, I don't, right. Exactly.
But he is raising some interesting questions about these ridiculous wars. We also were expecting, at least Karl Rove said that Sarah Palin was going to announce on Saturday, which she didn't. But what she did on Saturday at the Tea Party gathering in Iowa was rip into Rick Perry in an interesting way, which was using populism, talking about herself as a reformer against big oil companies, and that basically Rick Perry is just, he's got his hand out for every big corporation to, fund him, and basically attacking Perry. Clearly, I guess it indicates that she's still in the race. But I was kind of amused to think, well, you know, if the right wing in this country, if Sarah Palin can capture this kind of working class populist resentment against the big government, big business being able to buy a political candidate, they're welcome to it if the left is that useless that they can't step up.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that is the sad thing, that the left has failed its own populist traditions, I think, in that way, and that there is energy there. And the people are suspicious about these things, and there is a chance to tap into that. Palin's playing off both sides of the issue, though. I think she's only viable as a potential candidate. I think when she's a real candidate, she's in deep trouble. But right now, she can sort of run a kind of this funny little reality show she has going on as a potential candidate. So, the example we're talking about is a little problematic, I guess.
Exactly. I mean, I'm not for one second thinking that she's viable or desirable.
Yeah.
I mean, she's a poster child for anti-intellectualism. But
oh my God.
There's plenty of that to go around, obviously.
Well, trumped only by Michelle Bachmann.
Well, thank you for joining us here on this Labor Day weekend.
My pleasure. I wish all your listeners a happy Labor Day.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Jefferson Cowie, who is a professor of history at Cornell University. He's the author of Capital Moves, RCA's 70-Year Quest for Cheap Labor, The Long Exception and Interpretation of the New Deal from FDR to Obama, and Staying Alive, the 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.